give a little bit more systematic thought to it without any increase in cost, not hiring anybody, not buying a new robot, not buying anything, just thinking about who do we put in which rooms for which cases, we could start improving the outcomes that we get.
Hello, everyone. This is Cole from the American Journal of Healthcare Strategy, joined by a really special guest today to talk about some important topics in organizational leadership and management, medicine, and public health, and how they all kind of work together. Dr. Christopher Myers. Chris, please introduce yourself and what your current role is.
Hey there, Cole. Glad to be with you all today. My name is Chris Myers. I'm an associate professor here at Johns Hopkins University, primarily in our Carey Business School, but also appointed in our School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health. And I direct our Center for Innovative Leadership at the Carey Business School, focused on leadership development broadly, but my specific area of interest is in healthcare leadership and management.
Thank you so much for coming on, Chris, again. What got you interested to start with in this unique area of healthcare leadership?
I think when we look at the challenges that healthcare organizations sort of across the whole spectrum of healthcare providers, payers, delivery, we know that it's an incredibly complex endeavor. There's a lot of coordination involved in delivering effective, reliable, safe care. And we know leadership plays a really big part in making sure all of that happens. And yet we don't often devote as much time to thinking about the impact of leadership as we do to, say, the impact of technologies or new drug developments. But when we look at things like root cause analyses, more often than not, the source of error, the things that are causing us to harm patients are not a lack of technology. It's not that we don't know what to do or we don't have a medication to treat this particular illness. It's that information got lost, we dropped a ball, there was a bad handoff, all those sorts of things. And those are a function of how we lead and coordinate within our organizations. And so, I try in my work to bring as much attention to those issues as we do to clinical or pharmaceutical advancements.
One of the big questions I have based on what you just said is you mentioned that we don't focus on it equally or even really a quarter as much. Why is that? Why don't we look to leadership as a solution? Why do we instead, we'd rather spend money on technology or whatnot? Why don't we look at leadership?
I think some of it is that, as the health industry and the healthcare professions in general have evolved, right? They're very technical. They're very focused on their own clinical domain of expertise, right? Physicians are focused in, one particular specialty. Nurses are trained in very particular clinical capabilities. Pharmacists are trained in the sort of deep knowledge of drugs and drug interactions. Everybody's got their technical domain, and leadership is sort of implied or expected by everybody, but it's not anybody's one focus or job. Right. We have healthcare administrators, right? But that's a lot of sort of budget back end, operational management of a large hospital, for instance. But leadership is something that spans all of those different domains, right? It's not just something the hospital CEO does. It's a physician leading a care team. It's, a nurse manager working with, a whole unit. So it's something that permeates everywhere, but it isn't anybody's core focus or responsibility. So it gets left as kind of this, well, we'll learn that on the job, right? That's just right. Sort of part of learning how to be in an organization. We don't give it that same dedicated attention or training or focus as we might to a particular clinical specialty.
I think that there's challenge though in starting that training, because I know from my clinician colleagues, they already have so much going on with their day job, let alone all of the CEUs, whatnot. So I guess one of the questions is, how do you actually begin to tackle this issue? What have you found?
Yeah, so we have worked with clinicians, from a range of different backgrounds and also at a lot of different touch points throughout their career. So we work with folks who are still in training. We've worked with folks who have been in practice for a long time. And I would say, the strategies to help improve this are not rocket surgery, right? You know, there's nothing here that requires decades of dedicated study to master, but there are evidence-based strategies that we know from research in the organizational sciences and social psychology and other related disciplines that we could bring to bear and apply rather than just sort of doing it in a trial and error fashion or just saying, well, this is what I saw from my mentors, right? I think if you talk to almost any clinician, they know what bad leadership looks like because that was what their leaders did. But we don't give them a set of tools or examples to say, well, here's what good leadership looks like. And I think as technology evolves, right, there are things that we could offload. You know, for instance, when I talk with medical students, they're still memorizing and being tested on drug interactions, you know, lots of sort of technical knowledge that we might be able to offload to, you know, other resources and create some more space to think about these more social interactional kind of components of how they do their work.
That's important too. You know, and we have someone coming on the show in a little bit to talk about how the military trains and treats and how they've kind of streamlined different parts of the education process. So that's an important thing to think about, right? Is when we start measuring things, right, we can be a little bit more critical about what adds value and what doesn't add value. But here's, I guess, the big challenge as well. A lot of this, when we're talking about this translational science, right, trying to really give people insights, a lot of it is either very tailored to the physician or tailored to the administrator. It's kind of siloed. There's little information where you like both people read it and get something out of it. And I honestly think that that's because the information is in different places. I think that's one of the biggest problems. What are you doing about that? And what have you seen in regards to kind of that physician-administrator interaction?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely a challenge. I think you're spot on with that. That, you know, we're all in our deep domains of expertise. So, you know, if I'm a cardiologist, I'll read, you know, a cardiology journal. I'm not going to read a nephrology journal, let alone, you know, one of the journals in my field, which is called Administrative Science Quarterly, right? Yeah. Which I know from the title alone sounds like it's going to be a real page turner, but actually there's amazing research that's done in there, oftentimes with teams coming from health industries, for instance, that have a lot of really rich insights. But, you know, there's so much information that's out there. And I think particularly in the domain of sort of leadership and management, one challenge is that there's evidence-based resources, and then there's, you know, airport books that are sometimes based on evidence, sometimes not, but more easily accessible. Those are easier to find sometimes than the evidence base. So one thing that we really try to do is create accessible translations of organizational research. So work that our faculty or other faculty are doing that have really good practical insights about how we might lead in complex organizations, trying to make those as easily accessible as, you know, an online article or an airport book. Because in many ways, we face the same challenge that, you know, I'm sure all of your providers who are listeners will relate to, of, you know, patients who go on WebMD and they think they have a really good understanding of this, and they come in and you realize, well, actually, everything you're reading is not quite accurate. It's not quite based on the evidence that's out there. We hear the same things happening on the leadership side. Well, I do X, Y, and Z because I read it in a blog post somewhere. It's like, okay, well, that isn't consistent with what we know from an accumulating body of literature, right?
That's interesting. the WebMD illustration is very good. One of the ways that we combated the WebMD instance was we started a lot of systems started providing chatbots themselves. Mm-hmm. They were pretty limited. And so some people would be like, oh, this is junk. I'm going to WebMD anyways. But we did see that it reduced it, right? We also, you know, a lot of systems made it very accessible to chat physicians. So there's a lot of things done, I think, to try to reduce that. And there's still a lot of concerns. But the reason I mentioned that is in a similar vein, it's great that you're doing this work, right? It's great that you're producing this, but how are you connecting it to the people who need to be reading it?
Yeah, it's a really great point. And one thing that I remind folks, especially if they're in academic medical centers, is, you know, if you're in an academic medical center attached to a university, there's a very high likelihood that university has, you know, behavioral psychologist, has, you know, a business school that has organizational researchers in it. So there are a lot of local resources and points of connection. I'll highlight one thing that we do here at Hopkins. We're actually having it today, where we gather all of the department directors, so the chairs of all of the clinical departments, to get together primarily to share experiences and expertise with one another. But I join those meetings as a facilitator to bring evidence base on a particular topic. Maybe it's burnout for leaders, right? We say, well, here's the evidence base. Let's bring that into a conversation about what we're all trying to do across our different parts of the enterprise to say, okay, how can we build on successes that we're seeing really happen in practice, but also bring that latest research in? And so my advice would be, you know, look for the local resources, because, you know, I'm certainly not the only person who's ever done research in this domain, and I'm not even one of the best ones, right? There are really, really talented researchers, and I think there's increasingly an interest in bringing these together, because we're recognizing that we've done a really amazing job of improving our technologies. And so with each new technology, we're not seeing quite as big of a gain as we might have in the past. Let's take surgery as just an example. You know, when we learned to sterilize instruments, huge improvements, right? Mortality dropped quite significantly. When we went from open procedures to laparoscopic procedures, pretty big improvements of what we saw. But laparoscopic to robotic, improvements for sure, but not on the same order, right? You know, we're starting to see sort of decreasing returns to our investments in newer and newer technologies, which in many ways is a great sign. It means we've sort of cleared out lots of the room to grow and improve. Same in terms of sort of operational systems and processes. Think the checklist, right? The first few checklists were really, really helpful. The 98th checklist is not getting us quite that big of an impact. We're still in the sort of realm of being able to make huge impacts with the way that we think about leadership and coordination in organizations. The gains there, we're still in the sterilization days, right? We're seeing, you know, in randomized control trials of different behaviors, we see things like 15 to 20% changes in performance or quality of care delivered. Those are, you know, huge when we compare them to a 1 or 2% gain from a new treatment or a new procedure, right? So I think we're seeing a lot of interest in both understanding those issues and also in more researchers coming to try to study those issues within the health space specifically.
It's really important that we talk about this too in that context, because it's been the trend in healthcare for a long time. You're very right, where there's been a vendor solution, there's been money we can put at it, there's been a certification, there's been a training, et cetera. I do think it's very true that a lot of times it's education that's lacked. I agree. But it's also this free time to think, the free time to consider leadership, right? This protected time. And it's also just the challenge of it being an enterprise priority. I think one of the questions is, I'm sure a lot of people will be thinking, like, this is great. Like, you know, we have a business school at Jefferson, you know, Rush has a business school. A lot of the other institutions do, of course. You think about, you know, MGH, Stanford, they all have business schools. But there's sometimes this challenge. It's like, oh man, I got to get all these people together to talk about this. They're all, you know, think about Hopkins, right? They're all very busy. They're speaking, they're writing papers, you know, they don't like me, you know, et cetera. You get this kind of frustration. I know, you know, even from the other end, maybe, right? They're like, oh, I have to deal with these business school people. They're going to be, you know, weird or whatever, because there's this gap, right?
That we absolutely are, right?
Yeah, right. It is interesting. I as a pre-med, you know, I always joked about business students. And then now I didn't go to med school. I became a business student, right? And so how did you approach this, I guess, to get it started? How did you start conversing and interacting?
Yeah. I think, you know, The Venn diagrams are getting pushed closer together, right? Just because this is becoming sort of central. So if we think about it, even just from the business school side, you're seeing so many business schools invest in understanding the business of health and the business of healthcare, because it's the largest sector of our economy, right? So we're seeing more familiarity with that. When I started my career, I was one of the few organizational researchers who could tell you, you know, what a resident was or what, you know, what ECMO stood for. Wow. I'm far from alone these days because so many more researchers are moving in this domain. I learned from all of the great scholars who came before me in pursuing these different topics. But it's one of those things that is becoming more and more central to anybody who thinks about organizations. And then again, on the health side, right? I think it's just becoming unavoidable in a way that 5-10 years ago, we would overlook bad leadership, right? You could write off a bad leader who got really good clinical outcomes, right? You would allow that kind of negative behavior. I think we're just seeing a shift, right? Both from a broader societal tolerance, but also from a recognition that those kinds of interpersonal interactions, the way that we coordinate, are really what's driving our outcomes now. And for leaders to think only about sort of the ability to deliver care rather than sort of the broader coordination, the workforce challenges that we're seeing post-pandemic, I think it's just not feasible anymore, right? You know, 10 years ago, you might have been able to be a leader who said, I don't care if people get burned out, right? This is noble work that we're doing. You know, I just want to get the absolute best out of everybody. You know, ask any hospital administrator who's dealing with the incredible cost burden of turnover and traveling nurses and everything else. And suddenly burnout is not something that we're going to focus on with an ice cream social and, you know, a little bit of brand swag that we give out. Yeah. We're really thinking much more critically about how do we solve these kind of leadership issues rather than sort of keep them off to the side.
That's really important too, because of the expense, I think, of also addressing the issue, right? It's not just because you have to bring in consultants a lot of time. And so that goes again back to the business school using the local resources, right? There's a lot of people, a lot of researchers who would love to be involved that would not probably not charge you anything or might even be included in their current research. If you're an executive or an administrator out there at a hospital, and you know, you're at a university system, kind of like where, you know, we're at or Hopkins is, how would you prefer to be reached out to? You're like, what kind of email would you be most responsive to as a researcher?
It's an interesting question. I mean, you know, if you just go to the incentives, right, that faculty in any part of the university and the business school is no exception are rewarded for publishing high quality research. So being able to gather and use data for research is usually the most compelling sort of offer. It's also the way to get the best insights, right? So, you know, health systems are sitting on mountains and mountains of data about how things are going within their organization, from EMR, Press-Ganey surveys, all sorts of other things that are coming into an executive's office. You know, to be honest, most healthcare executives I talk to don't even have time to look at all of it, let alone think about what sort of analysis, what sort of insights they'd be able to gain. So I think there are some clear win-wins here that, you know, having access to that data allows the faculty researcher from, you know, an organizational psychology program, from an operations management group within a business school, to have data that they could publish in high quality research, but also provides the organization with a really rigorous, robust analysis and independent analysis as well, right? You know, you mentioned consultants earlier. You know, one thing with faculty researchers is, you know, our pay is not contingent on which answer we find, right? You know, it's not that we'll get hired or invited back if only if we find exactly what the executives want to see. And so there can be real value add and benefit to collaborating. And as you were saying earlier, it starts that sort of change in expectation as well, that this isn't something that's, oh, this is a bunch of extra stuff we have to do. It starts to become, okay, well, this is a core part of how we can make our decisions.
Right, right. And I think it's important to emphasize cost savings on both sides, right? Because when you're looking at a grant, data collection can be very expensive. And when you're, of course, at an institution, you know, Press-Ganey and Qualtrics and whatnot, those are very expensive as well. Combining forces can save money, right? We can eliminate cost. And then again, I like what you're saying. It improves results, right? We maintain, honesty and it's ethical. Even if it's anecdotal, have you seen positive results from this work at Johns Hopkins?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the work that I've been doing, I've worked with collaborators from all different parts of the health system. So everything from understanding the composition of teams in the OR. So how familiar are team members with one another, and what impact does that have on the outcomes that they achieve for different cases? Well, that is having a meaningful impact on how we talk about scheduling systems, right? Right now, it's sort of who can we slot where? But what our research is showing is if we can give a little bit more systematic thought to it without any increase in cost, not hiring anybody, not buying a new robot, not buying anything, just thinking about who do we put in which rooms for which cases, we could start improving the outcomes that we get. Similarly, I've done some research and work with our residency programs and understanding, you know, how do we start building this skill set for the next generation of physician leaders who are going to step into all these roles? And so, you know, it's motivating for me to be able to work on these issues in a context where it really will make a big difference.
When we implement a technology like, you know, I'm thinking Da Vinci's robot, right? They're so cool. I've seen them. Does that leadership increase the worth of that investment as well, because it helps the utilization of the technology? Is that also something we should be looking at when we're implementing technology?
I think it raises a really great point of sort of, these are not separate issues, right? A colleague of mine out at UCSB, and Matt Bean, has done some fantastic research on the implementation of robotic surgery and the sort of spillover effects that that had. Now, he looked at a negative spillover that we don't often think about, which is that it changes the process of surgical training. Right. So in an open surgery, you literally sort of move from the periphery to the core. First, you're watching, then you're holding, then you're retracting, then you're assisting, then you're in there. With the robot, it is just a binary. You're either driving or you're watching on TV, right? And there's sort of no in between. There's no intermediate steps to get a little bit more involved or take on a little bit more responsibility. It's sort of all or nothing. And we haven't necessarily adjusted how we lead our residency programs or how we think about surgical training to accommodate the fact that this new technology has effectively changed what it means to assist on a surgery or what it means to be part of a surgical team. And so Matt did really wonderful ethnographic research, sort of spending time in ORs, watching what people were doing to understand how they were working around that and what behaviors were more or less effective to kind of overcoming that limit. So yeah, the robots are big and shiny. I think to circle back to a point you made before, it's easy to justify that, especially when it says Da Vinci or Stryker on the side, right? We can justify that expenditure. Investing in leadership, thinking about how we coordinate more effectively, it's fuzzier. It's hard to point to it when donors come to tour the hospital, right? Yeah. We can't show it off in the same kinds of ways, but that's just as important as investing in our technology, and they do really feed one another. That if we're only doing one, we're really missing out on an opportunity.
That's great. And I like the way you put that in a way that it almost reduces risk, right? When you talk about negative spillover in that example, and we'll have to invite him on the podcast as well, but it seems like having strong leadership reduces the risk of that, because you're going to be examining, identifying those problems before they really get too far if something does go wrong.
I think it certainly demonstrates the value of that attention, right? To not just saying, well, this is the best thing clinically, so we're going to roll it out, and then we'll figure out how to make it work operationally or in terms of our coordination, right? I think we have often shunned that conversation of how are we going to coordinate? How are we going to think about staging all of these things? Because those are messy, tricky conversations. There's lots of different professions, lots of different stakeholders within the health system, and coordinating all of them is a lot more complicated than writing a check for a robot. And so we take the easy, shiny option, but we want to make sure that we're attending to both of those together.
That's strong advice. I appreciate your bluntness and your honesty, Dr. Myers, and really appreciate your time as well. You can tell from talking to you that you know a tremendous amount, but also that this is probably a good idea for hospitals to look into this area, because the way that you expounded upon kind of each challenge or each problem shows that we need this kind of advice and expertise. So thank you for coming on the podcast, Dr. Myers, and I hope we can have you on again.
Yeah, happy to be here. And again, these are not... nothing new under the sun, right? These are challenges that I'm sure your listeners are all very familiar with. But hopefully, you know, finding some resources, teaming up with organizational researchers can bring some systematic attention to those in ways that make a really productive change.
Yeah, I like the academic approach to it. I mean, I know some of the audience are going to say, oh my goodness, I hated school. I don't like research. I don't want to have to deal with this again. But I think, you know, Dr. Myers, you're so nice and kind. I'm sure everyone will realize, you know, academia isn't all that bad. So thanks again.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.